Found a story this week, and I think I had a very similar experience to this when I was growing up, but there was this little boy, and he was not exactly happy to be going to church on Easter Sunday morning. His new shoes were a little too tight. His necktie pinched his neck, which I can relate to. And the weather outside was just too good to be cooped up inside. And so as he sulked in the back seat of the family car, his parents overheard him murmuring, "I don't see why we have to keep going to church on Easter anyway. I mean, they keep telling the same old story, and it always ends the same way every time." And again, I think that's good, though. I think the story should end the same every time, right? With all those kind of things. And I thought that story was probably a little too personal, maybe, but that's maybe why I liked it a little bit more. But I think the story is fitting for a lot of us, maybe growing up or for where we're at, even a little bit now. But I did find these statistics this week just fascinating, because we do seem to see that same story over and over again, and it's great, I think, to have those reminders and those things to be able to tell us, you know, to remind us of what's going on when we celebrate different holidays. But sometimes it still seems like the point gets missed. The purpose behind why we're meeting on Sunday mornings, why we meet at Easter and Christmas and do all these different things is missed by way too many, I guess we'll say that way. And we won't go into the reasons why, but put some statistics for you. 100 Christians were surveyed by a minister from several different churches. And I don't know how official or formal this survey was, but I think it gives us at least an image of where we're at, maybe, as a culture. And so this pastor took 100 Christians and from several churches and asked this question: would it make any difference in your life as you are living now if Jesus had not died on the cross? So the question is, would it make any difference in your life as you are living it now if Jesus had not died on the cross? And these are Christians in churches that a pastor asked. 10%. 1 out of 10, 10% say they had no idea. I don't know. Could be. 25%, so 1 out of every 4, said that they thought so, but weren't sure how. Maybe, could. Not sure how it would look, but so that's a quarter. 20% said, nope, doesn't make any difference whatsoever. And 45%. Oh, excuse me, that makes more sense. My 20%. So 10% said no idea. 25% they thought so. 20%, 2 out of every 10 or 1 out of every 5 said it did. It made all the difference in the world, right? There's got to be a group of them, right? We're hopefully several of us are part of that group. 20% said all the difference in the world. That seems like a pretty small percentage, though, 20%. But 45% said no. I don't think it would make any difference. It's almost half of the people asked that it made no difference at all in their life and in their world. And again, that point of what we're doing and why we're doing it is missed. To me, that question, if Jesus had not died on the cross, would it make any difference in our life? That should make all the difference. That should make everything different. Jesus just coming and teaching, Jesus just being a prophet, Jesus, you know, not dying on the cross and doing everything else that he did just makes him kind of crazy and doesn't make anything else different for our life. Sure, we can maybe learn a little bit different morally and, you know, there can be some teachings that are good and we could pull out, but the difference in my life and I think most of our lives is that he died on the cross. And so it's, again, so frustrating maybe, but also really disheartening to hear if that's a fair percentage, if it's almost 50% of people that are in churches. Again, I don't know how to feel, about that. And a reason, I guess, why we need to have these celebrations, why we try to have the Good Friday service, which obviously we weren't able to do this year, but why we have an Easter sunrise and resurrection service, why we do different events and Christmas and Christmas Eve, and try to remind ourselves of what is the point, what is the purpose behind what we're doing, and why partially I wanted to do this God's Great Rescue Plan and figuring out, you know, how these pieces, how do these elements, these stories throughout the Bible fit together into this wonderful story, into God's Great Rescue Plan, and how do the pieces all come together? And so how we can look back and see in the beginning God wanted everyone to be together, wanted humanity and the creation to be all united with him, and how he's looking forward to doing that again, and how that story unfolded throughout the Bible and throughout history. And so this morning we come, I wrote here the conclusion, but it's not the conclusion, because God's great rescue plan is still happening for us today. So this is really the pinnacle or the climax, the high point, and I called it part one, because I don't think you can talk about the death and burial without talking about the resurrection. And so this is part one. Next week we'll talk about part two of this climax of what Jesus accomplishes. And there has been several attempts throughout history, even in our community, where we've tried to show in a play, graphically, videos, whatever, how Good Friday looked. And that's really what our passage is at. This first part is about. And so we've done our Good Friday production here, right? We put Matt Haberman up on that cross and, you know, mostly, you know, not wearing a whole lot, and he still talks about that kind of stuff. And we can go to the other extreme where it's, you know, not that our production wasn't good, but it wasn't quite the quality of Mel Gibson's Passion movie. And so we got, you know, different categories and different elements that we use for those kind of things. But I found this week, and I felt like it was worth sharing before we get too far into this, that since the 1950s, men in the Philippines had an unusual tradition around Easter, and especially on Good Friday, where 50 to 75,000 people would come and attend and watch this event. And this ritual would draw tourists to the Philippines to this odd and really gruesome Good Friday reenactment. So basically what would happen is a group of men, who refer to them as Christos, allowed themselves to be beaten and whipped, just like Jesus was, or similar to Jesus was. And so approximately 500 men allowed themselves to be beaten the way Jesus was. Then, as the years went on, they upped the ante, I guess you could say. So instead of just the beatings and the floggings and the bleeding in the back and the things that Jesus went, a few years ago, 17 men were willing to be physically nailed to the cross, their hands and their feet nailed to a cross, and they would hang there between heaven and earth. And they'd have something like to stand on, and I think they held up their shoulders a little bit with a ribbon or a cloth of some kind. But they would hang there from anywhere from a few minutes to an hour. Last year I saw an article about this that said there was one gentleman who had done it for, I think, 29 or maybe 30-some years, because he was trying to get to 33. This year was supposed to be his last year. I don't know if they're going to end up doing it or not. But if you're crazy enough to nail to a cross, I don't think you're worried about the coronavirus at this point. So, but they hang up there, and for an hour, for minutes, up to an hour, to experience, maybe for themselves, to show to those around them what Jesus experienced. And then they would get their wounds treated, and they'd receive, I kind of find this humorous, they'd get a tetanus shot. So at least they're taking care of that base, I guess. But I don't think any of us are going to volunteer to do that. If anyone at home wants to run up here quickly, we've got a cross, and we can make it work if you really want to do it. I can wait a few minutes. Okay, probably not. But the point is just how horrific the things that he went through were. And most of us are, you know, probably rational is probably the right word, rational enough to know that's not something we want to experience ourselves. And so that's what we're going to look at, though, this morning. If you do have an image of the crucifixion in your mind from a movie or from something you've seen, I encourage you to bring that up, because it does help. It helps me, anyway, to kind of read through this when we have some kind of an image to hold on to. And so we're not going to start in 26 like that says. We're going to jump to 28. We kind of know the introduction. Jesus has just been handed over to be crucified. Pilate has convicted him of to death, and they're leading him out to be crucified. This is after, and Luke doesn't talk about all the details of being beaten and those kind of things. And so we're going to kind of gloss over that. But we know that Jesus is heading down to the place where he's going to be crucified, called Golgotha, or the skull. And he's not able to do it. He's not able to carry. He's so weak or whatever to be able to carry the cross. Simon of Cyrene is brought in, which is interesting because apparently that name was significant enough for Luke to include it. So, but we don't have a lot of details with that. But I just think it's interesting that he's named specifically here to carry the cross for Jesus, and probably has a significant role in the early church. But then also we see this group of women mourning for him. And so these women are crying and mourning and lamenting for him. And Jesus says this to them in verse 28. He says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren and the women who never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' They will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" When I was younger, I'd say, okay, I don't understand this, so I'm going to figure this out, right? And it may take me all week, but I'm going to figure this out. And so what I've learned is studying this and breaking this down a little bit actually helps understand later on what we're going to read in a few verses as well, I think. And so when we read these verses, it's rather cryptic, fairly mysterious, the words that we see Jesus using here. And what I guess probably actually sticks out to me more is that in the midst of all of these things, Jesus is, you know, bleeding. He's so weak, he can't carry the crossbeam, and all of these things are happening to Jesus. And he looks at these women who are crying and lamenting and mourning for him, and he says, "Stop. Don't do that." If I was walking down, if I was in Jesus' position, I would be like, "You need to cry harder, right? This is awful. This is terrible." That's all. I shouldn't say it that way. That's whatever. But, right, I would be okay with them crying and lamenting for me because it was terrible, more than terrible. And so the fact that he stops says a lot about who he is. And what he says obviously then has significance. And so what he's saying, the way I understand it, what I've kind of gleaned from this through my studies, is that the point, the emphasis is on the they there, on this last they. For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? That they, to me, is the important they. So who is that they? And as I've looked and I've researched and I've studied this, that they has become what I believe to be the Romans. Because if you look at the wood is green, the reference is to Jesus. And there's two different kind of people that I've listened, that I read that said, one, it could be to Jesus' innocence, right? He's green, he's kind of that idea of a newbie, he's fresh and those kind of things, he's innocent. And so what will happen to those when it is dry, those that are guilty, those that are under condemnation, what will happen if it's going to have innocent person, if I'm innocent and I'm being led to the cross, what's going to happen to those that are guilty? And then if we take a step back in the passage, we see that Jesus is saying there are days that are coming, and Jesus has used this reference and talked to this about this several times before, and a lot of times our mind immediately jumps to Revelation. We think of end of times, we think of things finishing and ending, and the world coming to an end, but Jesus usually, when he talks about those kind of things, he's not talking about a future end. I don't even know if he ever is. Almost all the time he's talking about something within a lifetime that's going to happen. When he's with the disciples looking at the temple, he says no stone is going to be left on another. And the disciples, when is this going to happen? He talks about all these things that we again think are going to be at the end of the world. But they're actually things that are probably going to happen within a lifetime. And so when we look at these verses and we see Jesus saying in the coming days, he's not talking not talking days or years. He's talking not days or months. He's talking about within a few years. Within a lifetime, probably within about 40 years, in fact, that these events are going to happen, where women that are unable to have children, women that aren't able to nurse, are going to be called blessed, which is kind of the opposite of what we usually think of when women are barren, right? If a woman, even in our culture today, if a woman's not able to have kids, we maybe don't say they're cursed, but we would say that we feel sorry for them, right? Or they're still here. And that's the image, too, that Jesus is saying. There's going to be a reversal coming up. And in 70 AD, and it's, again, this is kind of putting the historical context back into what's going on. In 70 AD, there was a horrible experience that the Romans did to the daughters of Jerusalem. There was a horrible event that came into their context and caused them incredible pain. In fact, that reference to babies, women not able to have children, in Jerusalem at 70 AD, when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple and took over and basically destroyed Israel at the time, there were stories of women who would cannibalize their children so that they had something to eat. And so this reference specifically to children fits that historical context of what's going to happen. And so again, Jesus references forward and says there is going to be something. This is bad for me. This is awful for me personally, Jesus is saying maybe. But there is something worse coming for the people of Israel. All right? And I think that's so important for us to hold on to historically. But as we jump ahead to verse 32 and 33, we see Jesus being taken to the cross and those that are around him and with him. And so we see this. Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the Skull, they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And so we see here this morning that the criminals that are hanging next to Jesus on his right and on his left really epitomize or characterize the crowd that's around him, kind of the two extreme ends of how people feel, really even today, how people feel about Jesus. Right? We know the one criminal on Jesus's on the side of Jesus kind of mocks him, right? And says, well, why can't you save us? Get us off this cross. You can take care of us. And clearly by the other criminal's reaction and others as well, we know that this criminal isn't doing this heartfelt, right? He doesn't have the faith to say, yeah, God, you know, Jesus, save me or save us and that kind of thing. And so he's attacking him. He's mocking him. But on the other side, this other criminal comes to Jesus' defense, which is just amazing, right? These criminals, again, who deserve death, who deserve the, or maybe not deserve death, but deserve a punishment for what they've done, are showing us that there are two extremes to this reaction to Jesus' death. And the one is, again, mocking, attacking, and accusing. The other one comes to Jesus' defense and says, we deserve this, but you don't, Jesus. And I think that applies for us today as well, is that we can look at Jesus in two different ways, and our culture and our world does. There's, you know, the attack and the accusing and the mocking, right? And then there's those that say, we deserve this, but he doesn't. And then we can ask, Jesus, remember us, remember me when your kingdom comes. And Jesus offers a promise saying, you will be with me today you will be with me in paradise. Just an amazing image of how quickly someone's heart and mind, an attitude of repentance and faith in God can lead to someone being in that relationship and union with God and be drawn into that relationship with Jesus. Clearly that criminal hadn't lived the best life. But in that moment, he is heartfelt and he is compassionate and his faith was authentic. And so Jesus says, you are going to be saved and restored. And I should at some point in time just do a whole sermon on that criminal because it shows us so much. It's kind of a unique, it's such a unique element to the biblical historical references to conversion, to those kind of things. And he just reveals to us that really a faith that's authentic and heartfelt is the most important thing that we can do and have. And then we see as Jesus hangs on the cross with these two criminals, the events that unfold in verses 44 through 47. And it says, it was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, while the sun lights failed. That's about noon to three. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. When Jesus, calling out in a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Now, when the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God and saying, certainly this man was innocent, righteous. Just as the final few moments of Jesus' life seemed to happen so quickly, the trials and everything else, Jesus' death on the cross seems to be very quick, which I think is probably rather merciful in a lot of ways. If I was going to be on the cross, I'd rather be up there for a couple minutes rather than, you know, several days, right? Right, kind of a thing. And so Jesus' death happens fairly quickly of taking his breath and finally giving up the phrase that he says, into your hands I commit my spirit, we see Jesus still being in control, right? He's not able, he doesn't die, he doesn't pass away until he purposely gives up his spirit. But what I want to highlight here this morning is, again, that phrase that I just absolutely love, that I think all the Gospels use, where it says that the temple of the curtain was torn in two. And Luke doesn't reference, but others say that it's from top to bottom. Right, that temple curtain is torn in two. And I've enjoyed this passage. I love that phrase because immediately my mind goes to this idea that God is now out, right? he's kind of like this, you know, little kid. You open up the door and they're gone, and right down the I've never lost him down the street or anything, you know, and trying to find three, you know, one-year-olds wandering in the neighbor's yard. I've never done that. I think they've turned out okay. But it's kind of like that. I guess I kind of feel like that God has escaped. You know, he's this one-year-old that's gotten out of the house, and he's going to go everywhere. And that's kind of the first image that comes to mind when this temple is torn in two. For centuries, right, millennia, that God's unique presence was in the temple, was in the most holy place. And all of a sudden, when Jesus gives up his breath, God is everywhere, and he's always been everywhere, and he's always been accessible, and we, you know, can't get into too much of that, but his unique presence has shifted, and his unique presence is now available to all. And if we jump to the book of Acts, we know in the book of Acts how God's presence now shows up in the Holy Spirit inside each and every single one of us that is a follower of Jesus. But the thing that I've gleaned from this, especially looking back to this image of Jesus' words to the daughters of Jerusalem, is that something else has changed. Not only is God's presence available to all of us, but it's now shifted, but that's been a significant shift. Is no longer is God just for Israel. In fact, no longer is God's protection over Israel. And so he's allowed them to be vulnerable. He allowed them to kind of be in their own place. And so God has transitioned and made this major shift from the Old Testament idea that Israel is my people, I'm going to protect them, I'm going to take care of them, and I'm going to, you know, even if things go bad, I'm going to bring them back, and all these things that we read throughout the Old Testament. Now, because God has, that temple or that curtain has been torn in two, because of Jesus' words to say, daughters of Jerusalem, something is coming that you are not going to like. We can see that God's, again, the things that they need. And we see, again, in 70 AD how the Romans come in. They not only destroy Jerusalem and the walls and the houses, but they destroy the temple. And never again, even to today, the temple has never been rebuilt. Yes, we have a nation of Israel again now, but my understanding, at least, is it's not really a Jewish nation. There's so much conflict and chaos and turmoil there amongst the different groups that it's not really a Jewish nation. It's not that God has brought this back together necessarily. I know there's going to be people that would argue with me on that. But not necessarily that God has brought Israel back together for us today, but more that we have orchestrated in such a way to accomplish that. And again, God's presence is unique and profound over Israel like it had for centuries, millennia. But God's presence is now over all. And so I see this as a significant breaking of the curtain, because that allows for Israel to no longer be that special chosen people. But today we see that God has all people. And that's, again, why we look around the world. And for us, I think it's important for us as Americans, is especially because we get so caught up in saying, well, God's for America and God's, you know. But God is also a God of Mexico. God is a God of Canada, of China, of South Africa, right? Of all these different places, of the Philippines, like we saw in the story earlier. Right, God is a God that covers the whole entire world. And when we think that God is just for Americans, that falls well short of the plan that God had and well short of what Jesus accomplishes here on the cross. Because when that temple or that curtain in the temple is torn in two, God is now more visibly expressing himself as being the God of all creation. Returned home beating their breast. And all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. Just two quick things from those as we close. I want to say, and this is entirely speculative, I don't know if I have much to back this up with other than my own thoughts, is that the people there experienced something so profound, so awe-inspiring, so amazing, that something happened to each and to every single one of them. Whether they were a Roman centurion, like we read in a few passages ago, that all of a sudden realized who Jesus was, or it's the crowd going home beating their breast, or wherever they were at and however they experienced this, something profound happened in each and every one of them. And I think there was an opportunity at that time for all of them to make a choice, to be either ready to wrestle with God and to see who, you know, is Jesus who he was, says he was, and all these kinds of things, and go down that path towards God, or to, like the other criminal, walk the other way. But I think they all experienced something profound and unique in that event. The second thing is I just want to highlight who is mentioned specifically. And it says all the acquaintances and the women. The women here are highlighted. They're a purposeful part of the ministry that Jesus has done. And when we look back into this next week in part two, we'll see how the women were the first ones there again at the tomb. Again, revealing the importance and the lifting up of the women. And I could talk a lot more about that, but I think it's so important that we highlight that and point that out and see that in this story as well. And so as we close our time, we know the significance. I think this morning all of us, you know, probably here watching, probably know that yes, the cross is significant. Yes, it does change our life, and the percentages say whatever they say, but I guess want to remind us, even though we can't go out and we're not, you know, not supposed to interact too much, you know, we can send cards or we can call or we can communicate in other ways as well, but just encourage us as we move forward throughout this next week or so, is just thinking about, are there ways that I can make sure people know that Jesus' death on the cross is essential for our lives? It does impact, or should, and does impact the way we live and the choices that we make, and how, if ultimately we're going to spend the rest of our lives and into the next life as well. And so this story, I think, epitomized that well for me, and how the impact of the cross what the impact of the cross can and should have in our lives. And it comes from Chuck Colson as part of an impressive prison in Brazil. There were inmates that were dramatically transformed by the cross. And so Charles Chuck Colson reported that 25 years ago in the city of San Jose dos Campos, and it is San Jose, just throw that out there, San Jose dos Campos, a prison was turned over to two Christian laymen. He's just Christian people who plan to run it on Christian principles. So every person or every prisoner was assigned another inmate to who they were accountable. Every prisoner joined a chapel program or took a course in ethics or character development, excuse me. Everyone was required to learn a trade and to make restitution to his victim. In addition, every prisoner is assigned a volunteer family from the outside that works with him or her or him during his term, but also after he is released. And so after visiting the prison, Charles Colson writes, "You know, I found the inmates smiling, particularly the murderer who opened the gate for me and let me in. Wherever I walked, I found men at peace. I saw clean living areas. I saw people working industriously. The walls were decorated with Bible verses." And here's an amazing statistic. Over the 25 years that this prison had been run this way, only 4% of the former inmates had reoffended and then returned. 4%, whereas the nationwide percentage was 90. How is this possible? And Colson writes this. He says, I saw the answer when my inmate guide escorted me to the notorious punishment cell once used for torture. Today, that guide said, that block houses one single inmate. And so as we reached the end of this long corridor, he put the key in the lock and paused and asked, "Are you sure you want to go in?" Chuck Colson said, "Of course. I've been in isolation cells all over the world." And so slowly the inmate slung open the massive door and revealed the prisoner that was in that punishment cell. A crucifix, beautifully carved by the inmates. And the prisoner, Jesus, hanging on the cross. And the guide softly said to Chuck Colson, "He's doing time for the rest of us." Let's pray. Gracious Father, we are so thankful that you took the time, that you are taking the time for us to be able to do your will, so that we don't have to be stuck in sin and thinking about what death looks like, but we are free to live a life filled with you, and we are free to look forward to a hope of a life with you. We are so thankful for the cross, and I just pray that this week especially, it does change the way that we make decisions. It does change the way that we think about our world. It does change the way that we care and love for others around us. And I just pray you lead and guide and direct us through that. And we want to pray this all in your Son, Jesus' name.